Board Game Bros.
Hello, listeners.
Hey.
It's another episode of the Board Game Brothers podcast. I'm Jeffrey Craig.
And I'm Matthew Craig.
We're brothers in real life.
And game designers in real life.
And this is our podcast where we talk about board games, board game design, gaming design, all things gaming and hobby gaming. You know the drill.
Yeah.
So it's the end of the month.
Yeah.
It's Saturday. And that means that it is one of our higher concept episodes.
Yeah.
Not necessarily higher concept in the structure and writing of the episode. We don't write these episodes.
Right.
High concept in that we talk about a higher concept than just a single game.
Right. And this one, we actually had people vote on what they would want to see at the end of this month.
Mm-hmm. How many votes did we get?
I believe two.
Two votes.
And they both were on the same type of episode. So,
hey, you asked for it, you're getting it.
Yeah. And that is, of course, a genre discussion. And the genre we are going to talk about today is more of a subgenre than anything. It is competitive card games.
Competitive card games. We are talking about competitive card games today.
Now, this is sort of the catch-all umbrella term that refers to a lot of similar games that are usually referred to by their release method more so than their style.
Yeah.
Think of, like, trading card games, collectible card games, Fantasy Flight's living card game brand,
mm-hmm.
and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Much of those have their own terms, but they all sort of are considered part of this greater whole.
Right. So there is a diversity to the way that you acquire the cards, the way that cards are released and grouped together. But they all have a couple things in common. So let's start out this discussion on the genre of competitive card games by just talking about what these games all have in common.
Well, I wanted to talk a bit about the history.
Oh, but first,
because its origins.
Well, that's our usual structure anyway.
Right, its origins lend itself well to what they have in common.
Yes.
So, typically, if we go very far back, you could say technically that competitive card games started with whatever the first playing card game played was.
Oh, yeah, like poker or something. But no.
But to avoid being cheeky, now that we have that out of the way, the first earliest form of its current sort of type of competitive card game was, of course, Magic the Gathering.
Something that we're probably going to mention a lot in
designed
this episode.
Designed by Richard Garfield in 1993.
Yep.
And Garfield was given a prompt to design this game.
Garfield the cat? Richard Garfield.
I just said Richard Garfield.
I know.
Yeah, sure. Garfield the cat woke up on a Monday, and he was given the prompt to design a game people could play during downtime at gaming conventions.
I thought the prompt was, and I heard this from, I can't remember where, but I thought the prompt was it was a game that was meant to be played between role-playing game sessions.
I'm going
to
be honest, I read it on Wikipedia, but it could be that this was for role-playing game conventions.
I heard mine from an article that Rosewater wrote.
So. Okay, so, but who knows? Either way, in this sort of prompt mm-hmm. led way to, you know, Magic, and also many of the key features of these games, which are mainly portability,
mm-hmm.
small table space in sort of footprint in general,
mm-hmm.
and customizability / player sort of being able to player expression.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Also cards.
Yeah, also cards.
Yeah, which lends itself to the portability and the table
space,
you know, really, you could even use weird shaped tables because there's no solid board. It's these little pieces that you're manipulating. Like you said, the prompt was to design a game that could be played within a short time span. And because of this, a lot of competitive card games don't take very long to play through one session of the game.
And really, when you get to the competition part of competitive card game,
mm-hmm.
because we use competitive to refer to any game that's really not fully cooperative, that has players in opposition.
Mm-hmm.
But the important part in competitive card game is the competition, the tournaments, the playing multiple games in succession to determine an overall best.
Right.
And that's part of why I think the genre ended up becoming what it is, because it was meant to be played in short intervals, which happens to lend itself well to tournaments.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All right. So those are just a couple of the basic commonalities between all these different kinds of competitive card games. So let's get real deep into the design of a competitive card game.
So
is a competitive card game designed the way it is? I mean, even we can talk about why these restrictions and these or these common themes are important in order to sustain a competitive card game.
Right. And so there are two other things that competitive card games almost always have.
Okay.
That I want to bring up. One is some sort of faction or separation of the cards into different categories.
Mm-hmm.
Think Colors and Magic or, like, Pokemon became a card game pretty well because it already has the different types of Pokemon.
Mm-hmm.
And then also resource-centric play that tends to develop over the game. Progression.
Okay. So, but not really resources in the way that you'd think about resources, I guess, like in a board game. A resource in a board game is like a thing that you hold in your hand and that you collect.
Sometimes
and
count. It is.
I think in card games, I mean, usually because a card game is a card game, then it doesn't have like little tokens and little bits and stuff like that.
Well, nowadays a lot more are getting those. Like Netrunner has their credits and the Legend of the Five Rings has tokens that mm-hmm. you put on different
I just argue cards. That it maybe isn't common to all competitive card games. It's a little more specific to a couple.
Okay, maybe not games. That sort of typical concept of a resource,
mm-hmm.
but in terms of...
And that's what I'm trying to say. Yeah. Is that, like, you could say resource, but resource is like a card being on the field is technically a resource.
Or just a card.
Yeah, a card is a resource. It's not like you're collecting wood and or money.
True.
Or, you know, resources are a little more abstract in this kind of
But
definition.
A lot of the game, in terms of both design and play, is viewed as everything is a resource.
Okay. Let's talk about... let's talk about the design of competitive card games.
Yes.
Let's talk about... So, actually, I think maybe even right before we talk about that, we should talk about Timmy, Johnny, and Spike.
Ah, yes. Player psychographics.
Yes. Timmy, Johnny, and Spike are psychographics that Wizards of the Coast developed to help them understand how different players derive fun and pleasure out of playing their game. And by extension, competitive card games, or maybe even any game in general. So, they came up with three primary psychographics that try to cover every reason why you would want to play a game. And those are Timmy, Johnny, and Spike. We talked about them in multiple other episodes, but we can just spend a little bit longer in this episode to go over them once more, because these are also going to be brought up throughout our discussion. So, we'll start with Timmy. So, Matthew, what is a Timmy?
A Timmy is the sort of player that likes big experiences.
Yes.
They play the game for the flashy stuff, the crazy stuff.
Mm-hmm.
They're what people refer to as power gamers. They don't just want to win, they want to play huge things that are super powerful, way bigger than everything else in the game.
Mm-hmm. And it's not necessarily about winning with a Timmy. It's about, I mean, I guess in a roundabout
lose, they
way,
they go out with a bang.
Exactly. In a roundabout way, it could be about winning, but it's more about just getting really, really big. And that lends itself to winning a lot of the time, or doing really, really big things in a game will lend itself to winning. So that's like doing really wacky, really large combos or getting really gigantic, powerful monsters in play or dealing a whole bunch of damage in one big blast or something like that are things that a Timmy would enjoy in a competitive card game. So then there is Johnny is the next one. And Johnny likes to solve puzzles. Right. So and it's not necessarily about winning the game for a Johnny either. It's about understanding the really deep intricacies about a game and then figuring interesting and new ways that you can manipulate the parts of a game, sort of like use its resources in new ways that you wouldn't have previously thought about using them. Or maybe even building decks around cards that are very weird corner case cards that don't necessarily state how you would win if you would use the card. It just states like how you would do something new and interesting in the game.
Yeah, if they win, they want to win by doing something original or weird or really crazy mad scientist sort of thing.
Yes. And then the last psychographic is Spike. And a Spike wants to win.
Yeah, but they don't just want to win.
They want to outplay.
They want to earn the win.
Yes. So, yeah, Spikes enjoy outplaying their opponents. They like to have way more agency in how they win than the other psychographics. They don't want to make a big thing and then win. They want to win because they knew that they could make the big thing that the opponent couldn't stop, and they did it faster than the opponent could manage or something like that. Or they just want to, they want to control their opponent, and they want to determine, you know, they want to make all the decisions in the game. They don't want their opponent to make the decisions in the game. So they use like removal and control and stuff like that in order to defeat their opponent. So that's a Spike.
So to piggyback off that, there is another set of player psychographics that also applies to competitive card games in a slightly different way. While those three are about how players view the game and how they interact with the game, there is also Bartle's Taxonomy, which was made by Richard Bartle. And this was primarily relating to online games at the time, but it is very much more about how players interact with other players of the same game in sort of the community. And a lot of times, competitive card games, they live and die on communities.
Oh, yeah.
Of people that play together, people that talk about the game and talk about strategy.
Yeah, I mean, it's a competitive card game, but it's only that if you have competition.
Right. And so Bartle's Taxonomy has four psychographics: Spades, Hearts, Diamonds, Clubs. Spades like to dig up information about the game. They're probably the closest to what you called Johnny, because they view the game as a set of rules and interactions that they want to master their understanding of. Hearts are the most friendly, community-driven. They like people. They like to play the game with people and share their experience with people. Then there is Diamonds, which want to be shiny. They want to either be the best, or they want to have something really cool about them that's unique to them. They want to stand out in some way. And then Clubs want to beat up other people. That's basically it. They want to not only like win or be good, they want to do so in a way that is almost aggressive to the other players. Not in a way that's evil necessarily, but like they would be the type of player to play the control type of strategy that gets rid of all their stuff, prevents them from playing, and then drops a big thing that they can't answer.
They want to dominate the game.
Yeah.
Yeah. They don't just want to win. They want to win by a huge margin. All right, so these are all good psychographics to keep in mind that we will be referencing as to why competitive card games are designed the way that they are.
Yeah.
So I think that there is a commonality with all these players and the game itself, there's this theme with these psychographics and how they interact with the game, and that's that these psychographics all want to develop an understanding of the game. And it's some aspect of the game. You know, this is, specifically talking, I guess, more closely to the spade, of that description. But even so, like, regardless of, you know, if you're a diamond or a heart, you want to understand the game, and then you want to develop a further understanding of the game. Like, a competitive card game is a game that you really develop a relationship with as you play it. And I think this can apply to each of these psychographics and why they play the game. They're all searching for different understandings and developing their own relationships with the game. And it also applies to, you know, the reasons why certain aspects of a competitive card game lend itself to being a good competitive card game. This whole idea that you're building a relationship and you're developing a deeper understanding as you play the game. So let's go back to the common aspects of competitive card games, the reason why they were made, and the things that most competitive card games have in common. Let's start with one of them. How about we start with the length of time it takes to play the game. So competitive card games should be short.
Yes.
That's, in general,
a healthy amount of time for a single game, I would say, is about 15 to 20 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
I think at that point it tends to be not too fast that the players felt like they, you know, went so quickly then they have to wait time for the next game or whatever. It mm-hmm. also doesn't stay around its welcome. What's also important to know is that from a tournament standpoint, you want each match to last on average about 50 to 60 minutes. So that sort of time frame, 15 to 20 minutes a game,
mm-hmm.
if you're playing three games at most, mm-hmm. that's sort of how it maths out to that.
Right. I want to go back to that. You mentioned like you don't want the game to be over too soon.
Yes.
But you do want the game to end before you're done playing it.
Right.
And that's just a common thing for all games right, in general. Right, but
this is more so with a game that you're expected to play multiple times right. in one sitting.
I wanted to mention that. Yes, you are expected to play it multiple times in one sitting. It's important that you yes. play it multiple times in one sitting. Not just for the purposes of a tournament. Not just because you could organize yourselves in a tournament where there's going to be many consecutive matches and so you don't want the tournament to go on forever. But more importantly, a game, an understanding of a game is usually developed mostly by playing it multiple times.
Yeah.
So, you know, you say like, okay, you're like when you're playing a board game, you're inexperienced the first time you play. And then every playthrough afterwards, you develop something new because you experience more parts of the game. And you experience different situations. Maybe you try different strategies. And if the game is too long, then it's too tedious to have to go through all those different iterations. But because competitive card games are generically short, it allows people to go through those iterations and to quickly develop an understanding just by playing it over and over again.
And of course, this is important not just because, like we talked about, each player type wants to understand the game and develop their own method of understanding it.
Mm-hmm.
But also, in order to have competition, you would expect there to be a skill level and there to be room for players to learn from their play and grow on their skill level. So
mm-hmm.
that also helps iterate on that quicker and more feasibly.
Because right. practice makes perfect.
Literally. Yeah.
And it's hard to practice a game if it takes too long to play yeah. it. Yeah. So competitive card games should be short for those mm-hmm. reasons.
The next thing?
Yes.
Competitive card games are meant to be customizable and or diverse.
Mm-hmm.
So when talking about games like this, there often be different types of decks or play styles. And not only does this help with the whole like player psychographics, like in general, you would expect each one to have a different play style they might prefer. But also, it is worth noting that from a competitive standpoint, it can make the game feel like it's going on for too long if you play the same matchups every time.
Mm-hmm.
This is sort of a problem with the shorter game time, that since you're playing the same game multiple times, if you keep getting paired against the same enemy or the same playstyle, it can feel very tedious. But likewise, that also can be solved with having a more diverse amount of possibilities.
Sure. I mean, even if it's a more casual setting where you and a friend are just playing right. the game over and over, you know, at a kitchen table, just having the library of cards that you can go to after every game to change your deck and your strategy makes for a better experience.
Yeah.
And that library and that changing experience only exists if you have this selection of cards that you choose from to make a customized, tailored deck, not only to what you want to do as a player, but also to what you have to do in order to compete.
And it is worth noting that especially the sort of diamonds or, you know, the Timmies maybe,
mm-hmm.
they tend to care a lot more about having a unique and original deck that is their deck. And those player types might not be as interested in the game if they're playing the same deck as everybody else
mm-hmm.
in some way.
Plus, I mean, it's like, I mean, if you're trying to tailor to all these different psychographics, then it's easier to have just different cards
yeah.
than, I don't know, some other crazy way of changing the way that you make decisions in the game.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just, yeah, you should have all those cards, and yeah, and just by having the variety, then it allows someone to, you know, look at the variety and examine it piece by piece and develop that understanding that they have and figure out what they want to do with all those pieces given to them.
And in a further way, adding classes or factions or some division of cards among that card pool even furthers the idea of diversified decks and playstyles.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, think about a lot of these games. Like, Magic has the colors of mana you need. Netrunner has the factions and companies.
Mm-hmm.
And even Hearthstone has different classes that you use. So, and these all help promote diversity in decks. Also, as a designer, you can help make it so that, like, there's different effects spread among those. Think how in Magic, the most aggressive color is red because it tends to be the one with the most creatures that can attack on the turn you play it.
Mm-hmm.
So that sort of ends up helping just, like I said, divide things so that different players can get different things out of them.
Right. And it's like, you know, these psychographics exist, so you can just design to them, and you can use your factions as a way of sort of telegraphing how certain players should try to approach your game.
And there is a bit more to having different factions, but I want to talk about that later because it doesn't really fit in with this topic.
Okay. What's another... So then, should we stay on this topic? We're still talking about the customizability of it.
Right. Oh, another important thing when talking about designing card games. This is less as, like, as previous things in the genre, but if you were to make one, that there are a lot of accessories for card games like this.
Mm-hmm.
Card sleeves, playmats, deck boxes, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Trade binders. And it is worth keeping in mind those predetermined or already common like sizes for cards and deck boxes, especially because those can be customizable. You can customize them to have art or colors or whatever that you like. So allowing players to use the existing ones is helpful to promote people to play the game.
Mm-hmm. Sure, it gives. Yeah. 'Cause
once players develop time and money into expressing themselves in the cards, they want to go further.
Yeah, and it's also, like, it's not just a way for someone to just, to start from, like, the, like, strategy-wise, it's not just a strategy for somewhere, for someone to start, it can also just be an identity for someone to start with.
Yeah.
Like, you know, Magic has vampires.
Yeah.
So if you think vampires are cool, then you could just start playing with vampires. You know, you don't have to be a Timmy, Johnny, Spike, you don't have to be a spade, heart, diamond, or club. You just have to like vampires, and now you can do vampire stuff.
Yeah.
And that's another thing that factions can help with.
Yeah.
Let's move on to the next topic. What do we have for the next one that all competitive card games generally have in common with?
They tend to require low amounts of space.
Mm-hmm.
This is less on the terms of the player psychographics and more on just when you design one of these and you talk about like making it for tournaments, you are expecting players to carry all the stuff they need for the day, you know, the tournament, whatever, to wherever they are, and then unpack it, set it up, play a game, and then be able to move if they need to, usually after a match.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, just as sort of a quality of life, keeping the game light and small helps with that. It is also worth noting that you want to take up as little table space as possible, and which most card games tend to do, because the places people play at might not have so much room for tables. You know, I've been in shops that have had Magic tournaments that were like 32 people, and the shop could barely have enough room for the tables for that and have other customers.
Mm-hmm. You could even say in a more casual kitchen table setting.
Oh, right. You want players to be able to play it wherever they can.
Exactly.
I've played it on so many camping trips.
Yep. Picnic benches, cots. I
played games, yeah.
Yeah, it's, yeah, exactly. And because, like we said early on, you know, it's a competitive game. You need competition.
Mm-hmm.
And the competition can't always come to you.
Yeah.
You have to go to the competition. So it's more convenient that people have an easy way of transporting their stuff from one competitor to the next.
One location to the next.
And it also makes for, you know, if things are small and compact, then it makes for easier setup and takedown, which makes for shorter games, which makes for more iterations.
And it also means sometimes more sales, because it's like, oh, this game's so small it can fit in this extra room of my bag. I'll take it here, mm-hmm. and then you play it, and then those people are like, oh, I enjoyed that game.
Mm-hmm.
You know, get word of mouth out quicker.
It's also cheaper.
Yeah, that too. Typically.
Typically. All right, yes. Portability. Compact portability.
Low footprint.
All right. What's the next topic?
That's all I have for what these games tend to have in common, except for, like, actual game design decisions.
Okay.
Going further into that.
I have one thing. I don't think we mentioned it at the beginning, but one thing that these kinds of games typically have as an aspect, and that is that a novice can beat an expert sometimes. This is not apparent in many games, but I think it's an important thing to talk about. Because these are card games that involve decks, there is always the possibility that one player draws poorly and the other player draws better, and that's the reason why that player wins. And this is a good thing that a novice can beat an experienced person, because winning is fun.
Yeah,
you understand what goes into winning when you win that way, and so you can, you know, aim towards that. But it should be controlled how much a novice can beat an experienced player, how often they can beat them.
Right, because if it's way too much variance,
mm-hmm.
and you can never feel like you outplayed your opponent or actually outplay your opponent because it's just so random,
mm-hmm.
what's the point?
I mean, well, and that's especially for a spike.
Yeah.
But it's even more so that, like, any variance should exist. A spike would get upset.
Yeah.
So it's,
but even
like,
then, like, the Johnny can't do that cool thing they made up or
sure,
thought of.
Sure, with more if consistency. They
have, yeah. Or the Timmy can't draw the cool card they just got,
mm-hmm.
if there's too much randomness.
Right.
Every playstyle tends to get impacted by it in some degree, if there's just too much.
Right. I think a way to think about this in terms of how you design a game is by thinking about what makes a dead draw. Because I think when you're talking about the reason why a novice would beat an expert isn't because they drew the crazy powerful hand and the expert didn't draw their very crazy powerful hand. Because it even still takes an idea, it takes an experience and an understanding of the rules of a game in order to execute that crazy powerful strategy after just looking at the cards for, like, the first time, you know? So the reason why a novice would beat an expert is usually more because the expert is drawing dead cards. So if you want to think of it that way, then how you limit dead draws in the game and how you design the game so that most cards aren't dead draws is sort of like a more direct way to control how often a novice would beat an expert. So if you think about Magic, where you could consider it like the lands, they don't really do anything except help you play cards, and then the cards do many other things. So in Magic, lands are a dead draw when you draw too many of them, because you can only play one a turn, and so if you have too many lands that you can't just play one every turn, then that they're dead draws. And cards can be dead draws if you don't have enough lands to play them. So there's a lot of opportunities for there to be a dead draw in Magic. When you compare that to something like Yu-Gi-Oh, every card does something.
Yeah.
So no card is technically a dead draw. So Yu-Gi-Oh has less of a chance for a novice to beat an expert. These are just two examples of how you can kind of control that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Obviously Magic is very successful, so that a novice can beat an expert because of dead draws like that must not play such a huge role. But also, Magic does a lot to try and control, you know, how it, or it gives you the tools to be able to control the dead draws, it's very aware of that in how it's designed, how the different cards are designed. Okay, so yeah. Do we want to start getting into more specific examples of maybe like designs that certain competitive card games have over others?
Well, so I do want to mention that, so early on we mentioned resource-driven gameplay,
mm-hmm.
and we talked about how like everything in the game can end up being viewed as a resource. I want to talk about, first of all, these sort of areas of focus that card games tend to have. And so when playing a game, you don't want the player to have to remember too much,
mm-hmm.
you know, too much bookkeeping, memory issues, whatever you want to call it.
Yes.
And so card games tend to limit the amount of like zones that you have to focus on or that things can be in or go in.
Right.
Typically, you end up seeing your hand of cards, your deck, which you don't look through all the time. Your discard or used cards,
mm-hmm.
and then in play. And then sometimes there is the sort of side cards you can swap out between games. And that's like five areas mm-hmm. that matter.
Mm-hmm.
Really, it's just four that matter for a new player. So try to keep those down, especially because having to remember a lot can have mental fatigue over periods of time.
Right.
Even if it's in a short game. And also, if you use similar zones in similar numbers, it's a lot easier to get into your game from an existing game. And that sort of brings to the next sort of topic I want to talk about, which is that players have been playing competitive card games for quite a while.
Mm-hmm.
And they've developed similar skills. In fighting games, they're called fundamentals. These sorts of ideas about how to play a game and how to approach a game that carry over to pretty much every game of the genre, even though the games can be different themselves.
Right. I mean, and because if competitive games are about developing a deeper understanding of the game over time, the better understanding you can start with, the better it is for playing your game.
Right.
And developing the new understanding.
As a designer, as much as it is interesting to try to make a game that is really different from existing ones, you don't have to reinvent the wheel.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because you can also make a lot of balance and design decisions around existing knowledge of games. One example is card advantage.
Mm-hmm.
So this is since you use cards and you tend to get them from a deck, you know, and so forth, card advantage tends to be a resource that is in almost every card game. It is the idea that if you have access to more cards, you are better off.
Mm-hmm.
And so in a lot of games, you'll have like your hand of cards. And this is sort of a way that you can balance out different strategies, where if a strategy requires you to play a lot of cards early on, then that could easily be dealt with by a player who can deal with multiple cards with like one removal spell or whatever.
Right. You hear a lot of talk of one for one,
yeah.
one for two, two for one. And that's just strictly talking about how the card advantage shifts after using a particular card. Is right. one card worth one card of your opponent's, then it's even. If it's worth less than one card of your opponent's, then it's lost in card advantage, and then, yeah.
And this is actually sort of the core point of Yu-Gi-Oh!'s resource management, is that everything costs cards, and some cards that are more powerful require you to lose more cards.
Mm-hmm.
So that's sort of a basic thing. It's also why...
Or they require you to lose specific cards.
Right.
Which, if you don't have as many cards available to you, then it's harder to have those specific right. cards available to you.
And it's also worth mentioning that that also makes cards that give you more cards, draw cards, whatever. It makes those cards tend to be way more powerful.
Mm-hmm.
This is why so many card draw effects in card games that drew like two cards for one card for really cheap mm-hmm. are all banned in their respective card games. Ancestral Recall, Pot of Greed,
mm-hmm.
you know. It's because, you know, just having cards and being able to get more cards quicker is a big deal.
And efficient, more efficiently.
Right. And so knowing that, you can go into your game and not make that same mistake when designing it. Because you know what players will look out for as far as broken things go.
Although you say that, but there's an interesting thing that Richard Garfield did when he designed the early Magic sets. If you're familiar with Magic, you'll know that a lot of the most powerful cards ever printed in the game were made in the very first set. And, you know, you could chalk that up to just, they were inventing something completely new, and it's perfectly reasonable to say, well, they didn't exactly know how powerful they would be until later. But it turns out that some of them were actually intentionally made exceedingly powerful. And this is more of like a marketing part to the game, because the reasoning behind it was there's these very obviously broken, powerful cards in the game. If people are only buying a couple cards, just enough to play the game and maybe a little extra, then they're not going to have so many of those broken, powerful cards accessible to them. This kind of talks to the methods of acquisition of these cards, so this doesn't necessarily apply to something like Netrunner, but the idea is if people only buy a couple cards, then there's only going to be a couple of these very powerful cards in any play group, and so they're not going to come up as often, and they're not going to have such a huge impact on the game as you would expect them to. But if people buy tons and tons of cards so that they have access to all of the most powerful cards, then, I mean, that's technically a good thing, because you're game selling.
Yeah, and, I mean...
and people like playing it.
Yeah, that's true. Another sort of gameplay strategy concept that is easy to implement in your design is tempo. Tempo is sort of...
Oh, actually, I have one more point.
Okay,
sorry.
Sure, yeah.
One more point regarding powerful cards. And that's if you consider a game... these competitive card games usually start at a starting point, like a core set, a basic sampling of cards, and then you add to it through like expansions, whether it be like with an intro deck and then adding packs onto it, or with like a box of cards and then buying other box expansions to a game. It can be kind of important to put most of the good cards in that sort of core set, just because you would rather the expansions of a set change how the game is played or add new avenues of play, new ways of thinking about the game. You wouldn't want them to just be better versions of cards in the base set of the game. So you could maybe look at like Hearthstone for an example of this, where they have their core set always playable in their standard rotation, and then they add expansions which add new ways to play, but you always have access to those core cards. So those core cards might as well be, you know, at least good enough to work around with,
yeah,
and to become very familiar with, because they're actually good.
Mm-hmm.
So you were talking
so
about
tempo. So when you think of different strategies in games, they usually tend to end up being how quickly the player wants to win. So aggressive strategies are always, you know, really fast. Control tends to want to win later. There's in-betweens of different types. And tempo is sort of a sort of concept that relates to that in a way. It is sort of how much impact you have on the game versus how much impact your opponent has.
Mm-hmm.
If you play the typical example is you play a powerful creature turn one, then your opponent takes their turn one, plays a creature. On your turn two, you kill their creature and attack with yours. So then you have like a positive tempo because you have dealt damage and removed your opponent's turn one play, and they haven't been able to deal damage to you yet.
Mm-hmm.
So with that in mind, usually in card games, you end up having to consider tempo when designing them, because if a card ends up providing too much tempo, then the opponent of whoever plays that might never be able to regain that loss, that setback.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, clashes with, you know, being able to compete or like feeling like you outplayed, whatever. You know, you could just get shut down by one card. And also, it is worth considering what you can add to the game that can bring up that difference between you and your opponent if you are behind. Think like Magic has board wipes, which remove a lot of cards at once.
Right, catch-up mechanics.
And that also fits in with the card advantage and so on.
Mm-hmm.
It's basically about knowing what players tend to do with card games and see how you can approach that to sort of already fix the mistakes people have made, and how you can provide different ways for the players to overcome their opponent or win through skill through those cards.
And this, I mean, this also kind of ties into how you mentioned in resources that it's about the slow buildup of resources. So the how do you dictate the tempo,
the pace, like
the pace, the rhythm of the game?
Yeah.
How do you dictate how you start with slow resources and build the bigger resources? That will also tie into the tempo because that's all about like the speed of this game.
Yeah.
And the speed of each player's strategy.
Yeah.
And then one getting ahead of the other and maintaining that lead.
And so the last sort of part of how players approach the strategy of the game and how that can be related is sort of going back to why there's a bunch of different factions or colors or elements or whatever in different games. That is because it is to help avoid good stuff being the most prominent type of deck or playstyle.
Right.
Now, good stuff is just taking every powerful card or ability in putting them all together without any regard for synergy just because they're so individually strong.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at pretty much every popular card game, they have some way to deal with this. So Magic has colors of mana, and Netrunner has like their point buy for out-of-faction cards.
Mm-hmm.
And even Yu-Gi-Oh!, the reason why they're designed two archetypes is to help, you know, help circumvent having just pure good stuff decks all the time.
Although what Yu-Gi-Oh! Does is considered parasitic
design,
where rather than having like these general factions that exist throughout the game that are basic and they clump things together in such a way that it's hard to mix and match them, but it is possible. Yu-Gi-Oh!'s design is very self-referential with each faction that it makes, and it continually makes new factions, so they'll make like a Six Samurai faction, and all the cards will just refer to Six Samurai cards, and so they only work with that small like group of two dozen cards.
See, I tend to compare Yu-Gi-Oh! To a fighting game, where they're not making an archetype for the players to discover, they're building it with the intent of having each archetype its own sort of self-referential playstyle.
Mm-hmm.
More kind of like how a fighting game designer would make characters with their own fighting styles.
And maybe that's fine depending on how you intend how you intend for players to interact with like the chunks of your game. So like if you're fine with each of these different factions being individually different in such a way that they become more parasitic, then maybe you can maybe market it as such or something like that.
Make sure players know that the cards aren't really trying to be mix and match.
Yeah, you're not trying to make maybe like legacy type of gameplay and building. It's more these like packets or structure decks or stuff like that.
Expansions. Also, what can be helpful with that style is it helps you avoid unintentional broken interactions or oversights with older cards.
Mm-hmm.
That's only if you make, you know, past the first set or first couple sets. But I mean, like, that is one thing is that in Magic, you know, every time they print new cards, they have to look over a large part of the history to see how it might be broken and unhealthy in a format people play.
Mm-hmm.
And that just sort of goes past that by saying you can't even really use it.
Yeah.
So we talked about how players approach games, and we've talked about sort of just what these games tend to have. Now we should talk about what these games can do differently from what exists.
Okay.
And I want to start off with win conditions.
Okay.
So a lot of the like prototypes that I see people make for competitive card games are very similar attack the opponent with things and block with things.
And, I mean, it's kind of it makes sense in a way just because it's a one versus one battle.
Right.
So, you know, health is an obvious thing that you should be going for. And then having things stay on a field permanently and used as tools against your opponent, it makes sense that they'd be like troops in an army.
Right. And while I understand like that's also a very popular and common sort of method of play with like Magic, Hearthstone, Yu-Gi-Oh!, all those use that, there's still a lot of room for messing with how the win cons work, especially if you go towards like how card draw is changed. So, for example, Netrunner has completely separate win cons. It's asymmetric between one player is a hacker, the other player is a corporation. And the corporation has agenda cards that they want to score, but doing so takes resources and actions over time. And you can't usually score it on the same turn you play it, but you play it face down and there can be like traps. So the runner would have to normally steal those. And if you make it too obvious, they can steal. So there's like mind game elements. But then also they can steal it out of the corporation's discard and hand and deck. So there's a lot of different ways that that plays with the interaction of the game differently, where it's less about what's on the board in combat and more about mind games and resource management, especially card manipulation. And then the Munchkin trading card game that came out recently, that instead of you attacking your opponent with monsters like that stay on the board, when you attack your opponent, it's with face down cards that could be monsters or could be nothing. And if you bluff and you get called for it and it's not a monster, you take damage. But it's also like a way to help get damage through. So it ends up being much more of a mind game sort of, you know, bluffing and deduction sort of concept with that.
So you're talking about, like, rather than thinking of the win condition as defeating your opponent, some games, like Netrunner, more frame it as you're accomplishing an objective.
Right.
And when you think of it like that, then there's a lot of things that could be considered win conditions.
Yeah.
So that's something to keep in mind is to reframe winning as completing your own personal objective, and then you can probably come up with a different direction to go through than just attacking your opponent directly with monsters and weapons and stuff like that.
It's less that, like, it's not that every game shouldn't be attacking your opponent, but it is design space worth looking into to maybe try to make your game out more.
I mean, all the most popular games do this.
Yeah.
So, you know, maybe there's space for a popular game that doesn't do this. Or you could play off the existing, you know, idea we talked about before, how you can start with base level expectations that any player should have in a competitive card game. You could play with that idea of making monsters and attack your opponent like Munchkin does. And into, you know, you're playing things and attacking your opponent, but they're not always monsters, and you can bluff it and you can get called on it.
Yeah.
So I would like to talk about, we mentioned a bunch of different games now. I'd like to talk about the method of acquiring cards
in a competitive card game. There was one more thing to talk about, design space for new games that I wanted to bring up real quick.
Well, this is kind of a design space, but go ahead.
It is that a lot of games tend to have high numbers of choices for players to make outside of game. This includes things like deck building, side deck. You know, if you think about Magic, you have a 60-card main deck, 15-card sideboard. That's 75 choices that need to be made.
Mm-hmm.
And in something like Netrunner, where there's factions, that's also a choice, along with the deck and all that, and then what identity you use. So I think it helps to experiment with that, especially because if you want new players who aren't super invested in card games already to at least try your game, it can help to intentionally keep the amount of choices a player has to make kind of low so that, you know, they can make something that makes sense and it's not just a pile of garbage.
Mm-hmm. You could also just make those choices for them.
Right.
You can make the choices for them in just the fundamental design of the game, like you're suggesting, where you just make, like, the factions that, you know, you just pick a faction, you go with it, and you've made a good decision now. But you could also just work on, like, making the choices for them initially, and then allowing them to make their own decisions later on, once they've built a better understanding of the game. And this gets into what I was going to talk about, which was methods of acquiring cards. I've just used the perfect segue. What else is there?
I just wanted to bring up that there's games that have very, very, very small numbers of choices, like Dice Masters, which has 10 choices you make for what you play with, 8 characters and 2 actions.
That's not really a competitive card game.
It's a competitive card game. I mean,
it's a dice game.
It's collectible. It uses cards as its main, like, thing you look at and talk about.
Yeah, but it's not really, like, a hand of cards and a deck of cards and hidden information.
Right, but it is a
cards.
Similar release model and a similar, you know, atmosphere, similar people play them. What I just want to bring up is that that has so few choices, but each of them still matter a lot. So, like, that's an example of a game where even though you don't make as many choices before you play, they're still important, they still weigh a lot, people still talk about them. They're not gimmies.
Okay.
Okay.
So, now, how do you get the cards to play?
Yes.
So, obviously, there is the pack and intro deck model that, like, most popular games use, where you buy an intro deck that just has the minimal amount of cards you need to play. It's pre-constructed. It has a strategy and a theme to it, and it's usually a pretty basic strategy or theme. And then you get packs, which just add to your collection over and over again. And they also serve sometimes as a method of a different kind of play style. You could play a limited format using the packs in some cases. So that's one. That's kind of the smallest way to start a player is with just the minimum number of cards. And then you slowly introduce them to more and more cards by only giving them 15 cards at a time. And then there's, you know, there's Netrunner, which gives you a ton of stuff.
It gives you a base set.
It gives you a base set, which gives you, it gives you three runner factions. It gives you four corporation factions. Both of them have more cards than they need to form an entire deck. Or each faction has more than they need to build an entire deck. And there's plenty of extra. You can mix and match them how you want. You just have a ton of options right from the beginning with a big old box of Netrunner cards.
And then each expansion gives you around 30 to 45 cards, like by itself, but those aren't random.
Yeah.
Those are always the same cards for that set.
Mm-hmm. And they're not necessarily pre-constructed.
Yeah.
They're more like expansions, but they're planned, they're constructed expansions. And then there's things in between. There's like Epic, which has enough cards to make like two different decks, I think, in the base set. And then they have other expansions that also have enough to make two different decks, but they can always be mixed and matched using their kind of point buy system.
And also, Epic has their base sets made so that if you get, I think, three of them, you can form a cube, which is repeatably draftable.
Sure. So, I think, at least using the idea that we started with, where competitive card games rely heavily on a player's ability to develop a deeper understanding and a personal relationship with a game over time, the smaller byte acquisition model that the most popular games use obviously will help a player slowly build the understanding. It doesn't demand very much of a player right from the beginning, as opposed to like Netrunner, where you have so many cards and so many decisions you make. They make some decisions for you in the rule book. They have pre-constructed decks and everything like that, but it's a lot to take in right from the beginning. It could be a lot to ask of a player to have to understand that much stuff right from the start.
However,
as opposed to just having a small deck, just the minimal cards you need, you just got to know what they do, and now you can play.
However, beyond that introduction, it is important to think about how you want players to keep playing the game. And booster pack models tend to be pretty like iffy with players.
Mm-hmm.
It's very hit or miss in that like. It can take a lot of money to get a reasonable deck for some people, whereas like the core set and set expansion approach that like Netrunner and all and some of Fantasy Flight's other stuff do, that tends to be more approachable from a monetary standpoint.
From a player's monetary standpoint.
Yeah, right. From a designer's monetary standpoint. Because it takes a lot of printing to print all those packs.
Yeah, I suppose
and stuff.
It does take a pretty big infrastructure and investment to do that kind of thing.
And that's why a lot of new competitive card games that aren't already backed by a big company are the expansion set driven one.
Sure.
Instead of pet booster pack.
Right. But they do, I guess it also kind of, with booster packs, there is that element that we mentioned with how Richard Garfield started out Magic, where if people only buy just a moderate amount of packs, then not everyone is going to have the most powerful stuff available to them. So it's going to be a little more balanced, at least, if people are just buying packs and they just have a few really good cards and then the rest are kind of if mediocre cards that they have pulled from packs or had started in an intro deck. But then in the expansion model, you just have to buy the expansion and now you're guaranteed to have all the good cards.
Yeah, which can be helpful. Mm-hmm. I mean,
it can be helpful. It can also lead to, you know, a stagnant maybe metagame, or it can lead to, I don't know.
I think it's
less variety, maybe.
I think it's not less variety, because once you get past that very, very kitchen table level, then you start to homogenize anyways with the booster packs, and that's when people buy online or buy from their local game store. They get singles, and the difference here is that it takes less of a monetary investment or risk to buy in to the expansion card games, mm-hmm. and that is typically more appealing to people when they're getting into a new game, especially if they've already been playing another game for a while. Also, if everybody has easy access to all the powerful cards, then there's no, like, disparity in power level, because they can all get them easily enough and then all build powerful decks.
Sure.
You know, it's like if everyone's super, no one is.
I think, personally, I do prefer the expansion and the limited card,
right.
Pre-constructed pack of multiple, you know, options of decks versus intro pack and booster packs,
right?
Or maybe it's a mixture of like intro pack and expansions, but I think that there should be a limit to how many cards and just how many options, right. You give somebody, because like again, like I believe that Netrunner is just a little bit too large of a scale to be appealing to a wider audience,
right?
Because you need to start slow.
Yeah.
Yeah, you also need to give people a chance and meet them halfway. You know, you can't expect too much of a player to want to read into everything that you've given them and develop that understanding so early.
Also, limited play, so like drafting, where you get a random amount of cards and build out of that, is actually pretty important when you get down to what players like to do, because it is technically different every time.
Mm-hmm.
That's one thing booster packs tend to have over the set driven things, is they just use their existing booster packs they use to send out and distribute cards as the thing you open. However, like we mentioned, Epic had like the cube in mind, where you can shuffle together multiple base sets and draft from that.
Mm-hmm.
Or like, I know Netrunner has draft packs, which are just only for draft. They're not like, you don't buy them to get cards that are only in them. They're just reprints.
Yeah.
And personally, I'm along the lines that it is helpful to design so that if you're doing an expansion-driven thing, that you can have that cube as a possibility. Like, it doesn't have to be, you know, doesn't have to be front in your mind when you're making it, but it can help a lot in terms of longevity and interest. And even if one player has a bunch of cards and their friends don't have all the same cards, it puts them on a similar power level, mm-hmm. if they all want to play it.
Mm-hmm. If anything, a limited format is another way of slowly introducing somebody to something.
Right.
Because rather than laying out all the cards face up for someone to choose from, you are just giving them a handful of cards at a time for them to weigh against one another.
Exactly.
And pick out what they're interested in the game, and then try and develop a strategy and try and make those decisions of how to build a deck and play the game. So that's a good thing to keep in mind of maybe how a player could approach that, even from a limited card release expansion based delivery system.
And I'm going to be honest, if you want players to be able to get into your game easily, make a good rule book.
Mm-hmm.
So Netrunner has a very dense rule book that can make it hard for players to learn at the very start if nobody's teaching them.
And it needs one because it's asymmetrical.
Well, right. But at the same time, it's just like so many words.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, another game that I played called Codex had like the most sparse, like minimalist rule book I've seen for this type of game, which actually made it hard to determine if some of the things I was doing were correct or, you know,
yeah,
things that you're supposed to do.
And it's kind of interesting with competitive card games, because they can get some, like, the rules involved in competitive card games can get very, you know, obscure and corner case and specific. Like,
right. I mean, Magic, that's the whole point of a Magic judge for some extent, is that they know these very weird rules and interactions.
Yeah. You know, Magic is funny because it technically, like, in their packs, they print out a piece of paper that tells you how to play the game that's only, like, 8.5 by 11, like a folded up piece of paper that says, you know, this is the turn order, this is what you do, this is how creatures work. But yeah, the rules involved in an actual game of Magic that'll come up in an actual game of Magic can just go on for pages and pages.
Yeah,
and pages.
It's like an 800-page comprehensive rules guide.
But maybe that's something to learn from, and that is, and like you said, Codex has a very bare bones rule system, and then you probably didn't know what to do because they didn't maybe have like an appendix. So maybe it's like you think about what the very basics you need to know are in order to play your game, and that's your primary rule book, and then you have to attach appendixes. I see a lot of rule books do this where they go like card by card and do appendixes on how they work. But it could be, or maybe even you have a very basic rule book in the game packaging, and then you on the online you have like the more detailed rules.
Good use of technology.
I know that because a competitive card game is a game that you slowly learn more and more information about over time, then it makes sense to have a very distilled rule book to start with. And then as you learn the game and you learn its intricacies, then you gain a deeper understanding of the actual rules of the game. It would make sense to deliver them in a way that sort of leads a player on that kind of journey.
Honestly, it's also nice to have an online list of cards or database.
Mm-hmm.
I'm so glad that Wizards has their official one. That makes it really easy as a player to learn about new cards and learn about the rules for the cards, because the rules are just on the same page.
Mm-hmm.
If you can manage the hosting fees for that, that can be really helpful, you know, to get people interested.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Yeah.
All right.
All right. Well,
that's our full episode on competitive card games.
Yeah.
It's about an hour long. I think we're getting close to our longest episode, but I think we still got one that was longer than this one.
Maybe.
We hope you guys liked it. If you did, or if you didn't, whatever, you can let us know if you find us on our social medias. We have Twitter and Facebook at BG Bros Cast. You can give us some comments, let us know if you like the episode there. You can also give us comments and let us know if you like the episode on any podcast listening app, because that's where you'll find our podcast.
Yeah. And also, it should be noted that if you follow us on Twitter, we tend to do like polls and questions throughout the week or throughout the months that let you interact with us and give us direct feedback on a topic that's pressing to us about our podcast.
Right.
We also have our website at bgbcast.com.
And we talked about organizing cards online. We try and organize our episodes online. So if we talk about certain games, we always tag our episodes. You can search for them through there. If there's a game that you're looking to hear an episode about, you can see if we said anything about it on there pretty easily.
Yep.
If you're interested in going to websites that we give you the URLs for, you can go to entertainthegeeky.com. That's where our friends Chris and Roger host their podcasts, and that's also where we sell our merch and our games. Right now we have one game up on sale there called Merle's Truck Stop in Maine. It's a one-page role-playing game. Normally it costs $5, but for right now you can acquire it for free with promo code GEEKY.
GEEKY.
Doing that podcast thing where you have to spell out the promo code right after you say it.
That's just to make sure.
Promo code GEEKY.
Yeah. Then also coming up on Kickstarter.com. Yeah. That we are going to be launching our Kickstarter for our first card game, which is Conniving Cooks, a bluffing and deduction game for 2 to 6 players, in which players play as cooks in a fancy restaurant, trying to get each other fired while also making sure the guests get their food on time and correctly.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want to keep up with the news about that and the information, see when it goes live, you can also follow us on Twitter, Facebook, keep checking our websites, follow Entertain the Geeky on Twitter and Facebook.
Yep. Just follow us.
Yeah.
Hear us.
Yeah.
Listen. But thank you for listening to this episode.
Yes, thank you.
We do appreciate it, and we hope you have a good weekend.
Stay tuned for our Good Stuff's episode on Geekway to the West.
Oh yeah, we're excited to talk about... We played so many games.
I actually got gamed out.
That's impressive. I didn't get gamed out. I stuck it out till the very end and played a couple extra there. Yep. All right. So look for that, and thank you for listening.
Yep.